From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is campaigning in Arizona today. Last night, he rallied supporters in Montana, where he joked about the state's congressman, Greg Gianforte, body slamming a reporter who was covering last year's special election.
And by the way, never wrestle him. You understand that? Never. Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind of...
That happened as world headlines are focusing on the suspected murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. On his way to that rally yesterday, Trump said it would be very sad if Khashoggi is dead, and the president promised very severe consequences for U.S. ally Saudi Arabia if it was involved in murder. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC News and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
And Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Hi, Tolu.
Hey there.
And Tolu, let me start with you. What is your sense of how conflicted the White House is on getting tough on Saudi Arabia as more and more disturbing details come out every day about what might have happened to Khashoggi?
Yeah, the White House is really being sort of forced to take a tough stance, in part because members of Congress, members of the president's own party, are speaking out about what happened in Turkey against this journalist who is an American resident. We've heard the president and people in the White House say, oh, this isn't an American citizen and, you know, this happened in another country. But this is someone who was working as a journalist in America and someone who was expressing his freedom of speech and apparently was murdered for it by government officials of a U.S. ally. So the president has said that he is going to wait for the Saudis and the Turks to get to the bottom of this with an investigation. But it's looking more and more like he's going to be pressured into taking action by Congress. We saw that happen last year with Russia. The president did not want to sanction Russia. He wanted to have a better relationship with Vladimir Putin. But Congress, in a bipartisan overwhelming vote, passed new sanctions against election meddling targeting Russia, and the president was forced to sign it. And it's looking more and more like the president sees that fate and is trying to position himself as potentially being tougher on on the Saudis for what happened in Turkey.
Well, and Beth, one of the reasons the president is so conflicted about this is because the U.S. has a very important strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia, very important economic relationship. They own a lot of U.S. government bonds, a big oil producer. They invest heavily in U.S. companies. There's a lot at stake here for the United States if it does get really tough on Saudi Arabia.
That's right. And it's also that what President Trump sees as an important strategic partnership in terms of responding to Iran and what President Trump feels is a very strong Iran threat. So there are many, many reasons why President Trump has been reluctant to dig in on this and to take action against the Saudis. Yes, we're waiting allegedly for some report that's going to come out in the next day or so from the Saudis about what they say happened. And yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made it sound as though, you know, whatever they have to say will be something that the White House takes, you know, very seriously, whether they buy it entirely.
Yeah, exactly. There'll have to be questions about whether or not you can trust that report coming from the Saudis.
Of course. The idea that they are going to be policing themselves on this is kind of on its face a bit absurd. But what I think what the Saudis didn't bargain for in all of this is that it's not just President Trump who gets to have a say in how to respond. There's several hundred people up on Capitol Hill of both parties who are going to have a say as well. And what we've heard so far is a bipartisan condemnation of this act and a promise from even some of President Trump's stalwart allies in the Republican Party, Senator Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, others, that there will be a consequence paid if it's clear that the Saudis did this.
Tolu, I want to ask you about what we heard at the open of this segment, the president making light of this body slamming incident in Montana's special election last year, in light of the Khashoggi story that we're talking about now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's in bad taste at any time for the president to celebrate criminal action by a member of Congress, specifically criminal action, including violence against a journalist. It's an especially bad taste to do it right after a foreign government apparently took the life of a journalist on foreign soil by luring him into a Turkish consulate. Now, this is something that the president is trying to, you know, motivate his voters, and it was met with cheers and applause by the people who were at his rally in Montana. And he's realized that a lot of these rallies are no longer getting the type of live coverage that they used to. So he has to mix it up a little bit more and be a little bit more edgy and more controversial. But this is something that is causing headaches for Republicans across the country who are struggling to figure out a message for these midterms, and having to answer questions about the president celebrating violence against a journalist is not something that they want to be doing right before a midterm.
Okay, well, let's talk about the midterms here. This is President Trump giving kind of his closing argument.
This will be an election of Kavanaugh, the caravan, law and order, and common sense. That's what it's going to be.
Okay, so that's the president. And then here is one of the key Democrats running for office, Beto O'Rourke in Texas. He's the Democrat who's facing Ted Cruz. He's had a debate with Ted Cruz, and then he did a town hall. Here he is this week giving kind of his closing argument.
The bitterness, the partisanship, the pettiness, the dishonesty that defines so much of the national conversation, we are in desperate need right now of inspiration.
Beth, who has the edge right now going into the midterms just a couple weeks away?
Well, it's very frustrating for many Republicans that President Trump continues to sort of switch messages. They really want him talking about the strong economy, the low unemployment rate, the soaring Dow, although we've seen some ups and downs in the Dow recently. It's generally quite high. He keeps diverting from that message onto other things. And yes, to some degree, the caravan and such will motivate some Republican voters, as will the Kavanaugh hearings. But it's not the most positive message that the Republicans want him to be put forward and to have to sort of switch gears all the time and follow whatever President Trump is saying at any given MAGA rally is a little bit head spinning. On the other hand, is that sort of message of inspiration and hope from Beto O'Rourke the prevailing Democratic message? I wouldn't say so. That's a good message for him, for his brand. Is he's trying to kind of go for that very unifying
Obama
positive
style brand?
Yeah,
really.
The sort of Obama style from 2007. But really, out in the states, what we're mostly seeing is Democrats talking about health care. They feel like that is the winning message. That's what voters want to talk about. They're very concerned that protections for pre-existing conditions will be removed from insurance plans if Republicans get back in there. So Democrats are really trying to stay focused on that. So we will see who's got the stronger message in just a couple of weeks.
But Tolu, we are seeing reporting this week that Republicans are starting to feel just a little bit more confident heading into November. I mean, do you think they have any reason to be?
Well, they did see the Kavanaugh hearings as a net positive for them in terms of the enthusiasm gap. We've seen incredible enthusiasm among Democrats over the past couple of years in special elections and in the election in Virginia, high turnout rates, and we haven't seen that matched by Republicans. They believe that the Kavanaugh hearings helped to bring some of those Republicans on board and make them more enthusiastic. It's hard to tell how much of that is spin versus actual polling and numbers that will actually manifest in turnout. I think the Democrats still have the edge just because they obviously have history on their side, but there's so much angst about President Trump, so much motivation to get out and send him a message. And we've already started to see some numbers in early voting that shows that Democrats are turning out in high numbers. Now, we'll have to wait and see if that sustains itself throughout the next couple of weeks and on Election Day. But right now, the Democrats do have the edge.
So one thing that we have not been able to talk about because it just keeps getting overshadowed by other news is what happened with Nikki Haley. You know, she's left her job as the UN ambassador for the United States. And then she said this last night at the Al Smith dinner.
In our toxic political environment, I've heard some people in both parties describe their opponents as enemies or evil. In America, our political opponents are not evil.
Okay, Beth, what do you read into that about Nikki Haley?
Nikki Haley has a political future. She wants a political future, and she is staking out her own territory separate and apart from the president. She's actually played this pretty smart. I mean, her whole stint in the cabinet was a very smart way for her to get herself out there and get a national reputation, get an international reputation without being too closely tied to the president. Physically, she was distant from him. She was up in New York when he's down in Washington. She would stake out positions at the UN that actually contradicted things that he would say in Washington on Russia and other topics. And now she's basically walking away from the cabinet on her own terms to set up her own political life in the future. I do not believe that she intends to run against him in 2020. Hmm. She says she won't. There's no reason for her to do so, but she's a young woman, and she's got quite a future. And she, what we saw last night was her staking that out for the years to come.
Tolu, that means if she doesn't run in 2020, and it does seem a stretch that she might, if she doesn't, she has to stay relevant for a very long time.
Yeah, that's the case, and she plans to do that. She said she was going to campaign for President Trump in 2020, but she's also making these statements that are very much contradicting what the president has said. The president has called his political opponents evil. He's called the press the enemy of the people, and she's staking out a position that's very different from that. So she's trying to figure out how to stay relevant. She could pursue higher office or pursue the Senate, some have said, between now and 2024. But I think her political brand is so hot that she could remain relevant throughout the next several years as a surrogate and as a campaign supporter for not only President Trump, but other Republicans who want to have a more moderate and welcoming version of conservatism in contrast to the president.
That is Tolu Olorunipa with Bloomberg and Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC News and MSNBC. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And by the way, we'll be in Florida next week broadcasting ahead of the election. Some big races there. Tomorrow's parliamentary elections in Afghanistan's Kandahar province will be delayed a week after deadly Taliban attack there yesterday. The elections will be held as scheduled across the rest of the country. A powerful local police chief was killed by gunmen in Kandahar. General Scott Miller, commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, narrowly escaped injury. It marked the first time since the 2001 U.S.-led invasion that the top American commander in Afghanistan has been involved in an incident like this. Joining us now is the BBC chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. She's in Kabul, Afghanistan. Lise, there have been a number of recent Taliban attacks in the run-up to this election, but this one in Kandahar was especially brazen. What does it say to you about the security situation there?
This was the most devastating attack by the Taliban against the senior leadership in Afghanistan, taking place in Kandahar, a critical province, so the former heartland of the Taliban. They still have a network of sympathizers, still have the ability to carry out this kind of spectacular attack, wiping out the senior leadership, including the powerful police chief, General Abdul Razak. Some have raised questions about his tactics in trying to improve security in the province. So there's no denying he was a linchpin in bringing a better security and stability to this area, not just to Kandahar, but to the entire south. So it really has sent a shiver right across Afghanistan, and happening so soon before these critical parliamentary polls. We're still waiting to hear all the details about how this was done, but we understand it was committed by a member of his security team, a young bodyguard, underlining again the ability of the Taliban to somehow persuade, woo, bribe, encourage young Afghans to act for them right in the heart of the Afghan authority administration.
And it does come just 2 days before the parliamentary elections in Afghanistan. Do you think that it's related to that?
The Taliban will strike whenever they can. They have vowed to attack these polls. They've urged Afghan citizens like teachers and students not to vote, not to put themselves up in harm's way. They have said that they will try very hard not to injure, to kill civilians, but they've made it clear that they will attack security forces and they will attack this electoral machinery. They say this is very much an electoral exercise carried out for the West, and they want Afghanistan to have no part of it. So security forces across Afghanistan are on high alert. It's hard to know when and how they will attack. I remember I was here for the last elections in Afghanistan, which were presidential elections, and the Taliban had been convinced by Pakistan, by other forces, not to attack the polls, but they carried out a devastating attack after the polls closed. We can't say for certain what will happen this time. I know the efforts have been made to try to convince the Taliban not to damage this crucial process. But of course, no matter what the Taliban do or don't do, there's still the forces of Islamic State, and they will listen to no one. And they have carried out some of the most brutal attacks, including here in the heart of Kabul.
Are American troops going to be involved in election-related security this weekend?
This is very much an Afghan-led process, and the Afghans are very proud of that. The Ring of Steel, as they call it, around Kabul, is very much a matter for Afghan police, Afghan military, Afghan intelligence. We were visiting the control room of the Afghan police this week. They showed us all their security cameras right across the city, keeping an eye on all the major streets and the thoroughfares. Of course, the NATO forces, including the Americans, are in the background, advising, providing intelligence. They, of course, have their aircraft. But when it comes to securing the vote, and there's said to be more than 50,000 forces involved, this is very much Afghans who will be right at the front for protecting Afghan people.
It's been 17 years now since the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan that toppled the Taliban. It doesn't sound like they are giving up anytime soon, that they still would like to retake control of the country.
Well, that's a big question. I think there have been studies which show that the Taliban are either controlling or have influence in a very large number of Afghan districts. The estimates go anywhere from 50 to 70% of the districts. But it has always been said that they cannot take the capital, Kabul, which would be the most heavily secured part of Afghanistan and, of course, would involve a lot of bloodshed, which is why there is great hope being invested now in the new signs that possibly peace talks could begin. There's the new American envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, who was born in Afghanistan, is now a leading American official. He's a former American ambassador to Afghanistan.
Right.
He's been visiting the Taliban, talking to Pakistan, talking to the Afghans, and hoping very much to start a process which gets the Taliban and the Afghan government around the table to negotiate an end to this war. And of course, that would involve discussion of the Taliban's main demand that American and other Western security forces leave Afghanistan.
Lise Doucette, after all of your trips to Afghanistan over the years, what strikes you about the country right now in 2018?
What really strikes me about Afghanistan now is that the new war is very much between the dark forces of the past, including the Taliban, including the powerful warlords, including the drug lords and the criminal networks, and against a new educated generation of Afghans who are truly inspiring. Often the reports we hear are of young Afghans leaving for Europe, saying they have no future here, turning their back on their country. But when you come to Afghanistan, what you see is highly educated young Afghans determined to stay here, knowing the risks, and they are running in record numbers in these parliamentary elections, trying to take on the old forces, including the warlords and their sons, mostly sons, who are running in these elections. So it is very much an election posed between hope and fear. And the greatest hope is that political space, safe political space, will be opened enough to let this new generation have a greater say in forging a new future for this long embattled country.
That's the BBC chief international correspondent Lise Doucette in Kabul, Afghanistan, as Afghans prepare to vote in parliamentary elections this weekend. Lise, thank you so much as always.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Next year, smartphones equipped for 5G connections will start hitting the market in the U.S., but they won't be much of an upgrade unless they're connected to a new 5G wireless network. The race to build those is on, but some communities want to step on the brakes. Here's Jim Saxa from member station WHYY.
Doylestown, Pennsylvania is a charming little town just north of Philadelphia, and it's caught up in a clash between technological progress and local control. Borough Council President Jack O'Brien is explaining just how Doylestown got into this mess when suddenly the call cuts out.
And the Public Utility Commission.
Hey, Jack, you still there?
Cell phone coverage is spotty in Doylestown, and that's a bit ironic, given why O'Brien was calling. The borough just fought a lawsuit to stop a cellular company from upgrading wireless coverage in the area. The company Crown Castle is building a web of next-gen wireless antennas. They're smaller in size and in coverage area than the big cell towers our smartphones currently connect to. And that means you have to install them all over, like one or two per block. O'Brien says people thought that would ruin the town's charm.
In the center of town here, we have what we call historic light poles. They're cast iron and decorative
And, you know, we wanted to kind of maintain the sense of that. And they were proposed in coming in and just putting wooden poles in. And in some cases, they would be 50 feet high. And they just didn't fit with the nature of the town.
The two sides ended up settling. Crown Castle gets to build their infrastructure network, but they'll have to hide it as best they can. The new cell antennas are the foundation for the next generation of cellular technology, 5G. It's like adding lanes to a highway, opening up bandwidth to connect devices and ramp up speeds at levels currently not possible. 5G backers say it will bring about that wondrous future that we were always promised at expos like the 1962 World's Fair.
One day you may be able to call home and automatically turn off the oven. Or, from a public telephone a couple of hundred miles away, turn on your home air conditioner and have the house nice and cool.
50 plus years later, that not too distant future is already here, says Pennsylvania State Representative Frank Ferry.
Basically, everybody's becoming connected in their home in one form or another. And I actually notice it when I'm out campaigning. I ring some people's doorbells, and they're not home. They start talking to me through their phone, you know, while I'm at their doorstep.
Ferry, a Republican, is sponsoring a bill that aims to make it easier for wireless companies to build their 5G networks. It would strip local governments of their ability to control what gets installed on their streets, effectively preventing towns like Doylestown from negotiating their own deals. So far, local governments have opposed the bill, but they say they're open to a compromise so long as they keep a say in what the future of wireless technology ends up looking like in their downtowns. Crown Castle spokesman Rory Whalen says the bill's needed to keep Pennsylvania on pace in the 5G race.
5G is coming to every community in America. The question is, who's at the front of the line and who's at the back of the line?
That every community comes with an asterisk. No matter how this technology is rolled out here in Pennsylvania, or anywhere else for that matter, cities and suburbs, with their concentrations of potential customers, will likely be at the front of the line. And rural communities will probably end up waiting a whole lot longer when it comes to connecting to new 5G networks. For Here and Now, I'm Jim Saxa.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We learned today that China's economic growth is at its slowest level since the global financial crisis. The economy there grew 6.5% in the quarter that ended last month, down from 6.7% a year ago. China's stock market is down 30% since January, and the currency, the yuan, is falling against the dollar. The country's finance officials today launched a media blitz to try to shore up confidence in the economy. Joining us now is NPR Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jeremy.
So 6.5%, we'd love that kind of a growth rate in the United States. In China, it's
right.
Bad news.
It is bad news. Yeah, 6.5%. We haven't seen that since 2009, and that was when the global financial crisis hit and had a pretty tremendous impact on China and the jobs in China. You know, there were many, many jobs lost after that. And so going back to that is not what I think China's regulators and China's bankers and China's economic planners were hoping for.
And so what is causing it? Is it mostly the tariffs from the United States?
Well, China's economy has been lagging for the last few years. You know, the government is dealing with a lot of problems. You've got public debt spiraling out of control. You've got a fairly significant property bubble in urban China. And the biggest pressure on the economy comes from this historic transition that China's making to shift the way that its economy runs, moving from an economy based on building things to one based on buying things. And when you're the second largest economy in the world and you're managing 1.4 billion people, that type of economic transition is pretty painful and pretty complicated. And that's part of what we're seeing here.
And are they expecting that it's going to last for a long time, this downturn, or that they'll be able to work their way out of it somehow?
Well, I think that's where the tariffs come into play, because we've got, in the midst of a downturn, we've got these tariffs from the United States, and that is happening at a pretty vulnerable time for China. So when you look at both the fact that China's economy is already lagging, its markets are tumbling, and its currency is also starting to decline pretty quickly here. And then you've got these new tariffs coming forth. I think that's creating a lot of psychological barriers for the Chinese, and it's basically making people try to make shore up what they've got. And I think the entire system is preparing for a big shock right now.
Well, you mentioned the currency. It hit a two-year low against the dollar this week. And President Trump has been accusing China of keeping the currency artificially low. So when the currency hits a two-year low, is that by design or is that by accident?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, the economists I talk to are dismissing this idea that China's purposely weakening its currency to make its exports cheaper. China used to do that, but that's not really what's happening now. What's happening is that the U.S. dollar is stronger than ever thanks to President Trump's tax cuts and the Fed's raised interest rates. In fact, it's fair to say here that China doesn't want its currency to be depreciating this fast because it can lead to inflation, and that's the last thing China needs right now. And what's interesting also is that China is manipulating its currency, but it's doing so in the opposite direction of what Trump has accused China of doing. Since the summer, China's been trying to strengthen its currency so that it wouldn't weaken so fast. So if China should stop manipulating its currency, the yuan would weaken much faster, which is what Trump does not want, because that could lead to an even bigger trade deficit between the U.S. and China.
It's NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
We've been looking at climate change stories this week, and today we're going to zoom in on one statistic. By 2050, the World Bank predicts that climate change could create as many as 143 million climate migrants, people moving to new places to escape conditions that are making it difficult to live. To put that into context, that's double the number of refugees in the world today. And while that migration would be unprecedented, we have seen smaller movements because of climate before, and many times within the United States. Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly are historians and hosts of the podcast Backstory. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks. Hey, Peter.
Now, I know you're both U.S. historians, but I'm going to ask you to stretch the limits of your scholarship here way, way back to long before we were ever a country. What was the first human migrations that we saw because of climate in North America?
Well, archaeologists tell us that you have, at least in the 12th or 13th century, Native Americans who are migrating because of massive droughts in the West and Southwest. And the Americas, of course, are being populated by people who are migrating from Asia. So we have no sense of all the ways in which climate was driving them in the first place. But even in those migrations in the 12th and 13th century, you have a very clear reliance on crops like maize, ways in which people are not able to rely on the consistency of the rains. I mean, decades-long droughts in some cases. And so these populations are being forced to move and to come into contact. And so you have the Zuni and the Hopi and the Mogollon who are moving through and trying to find new villages, in some cases moving along rivers and creating new moments of cultural contact, but at great stress. I mean, you're talking about thousands of people who are forced to move and relocate, oftentimes abandoning whole cities or civilizations. Some of those places that we now see as tourist attractions in the Southwest are these empty villages in the hillside. Some of those are a product of these large, massive migrations. As another side point of this, of course, when the Europeans arrive, many of them are migrants of a very related sort. I mean, they're fleeing certain kinds of hardship in Europe, and many of them are talking about, for instance, the abundant timber in places like North America and trying to find ways in which they can get a slightly more regular livelihood, given the deforestation that happened in Europe in the 18th and 19th century. And so there's going to be a constant relationship between mass migrations and concerns about the climate and sustainability.
And then once those Europeans got here and started establishing their own communities here, what happened? I mean, do we see similar things moving forward?
Well, we need to think about the relationship between climate and change is initiated by people as well. Mm-hmm. You could argue that the two of the worst things that have ever happened in American history are directly related to that process, which is the forced migration of a million people across the American South because the climate there enabled this new crop of cotton that tied back to Europe the way that Nathan was talking before, these new industries that are driving it. And you would found that...
And you're referring to slavery. I mean, I'm sorry, just to be specific there, you're referring to slavery.
I'm talking about. And you would have seen, in many ways, the worst slavery in southern Louisiana in the sugar cane fields, mm-hmm. which go up to the very boundary of where the climate will allow them to go, and mm-hmm. the rice fields on the Atlantic coast. So you see very finely attuned, really, to just a few degrees temperatures you were talking about before, about how you can have this forced migration of millions of people in slavery.
So I'm hearing a theme here that people tend to follow where the plants and the crops will go, because, of course, that's mm-hmm. how we sustain ourselves, but also our economies. What about other reasons that people moved historically related to the climate?
Well, if you think about the large concern now around Atlantic storms, there again, there's a history to the ways in which hurricanes have forced all kinds of people to basically pull up stakes and relocate. I mean, this again has a kind of hemispheric impact. If you think, for instance, about some of the Atlantic storms that came through the Caribbean or even hit the Southeast in the early part of the 20th century, many of these were quite cataclysmic with really substantial effects. I mean, you think about a storm in 1917 that really is racking the Caribbean and forcing people in the U.S. to send remittances back. In the 1950s, you have a massive storm hit Jamaica that helps to spawn migration to England in that decade. And even in the United States, there's a huge hurricane in 1947, late September, that creates a huge problem of displacement in the southeast of the United States, because largely the infrastructure isn't there. And this is a reminder to listeners to think about unnatural disasters, right? The Hurricane Katrina disaster in New Orleans was about levees breaking, for instance. And in the South in the 1940s, you had farmers who were being displaced. Folks who were relocated because of racial segregation statutes in the South had their whole homes relocated and then subsequently ripped up by massive hurricanes. You're talking about hundreds, in some cases, thousands of migrants of Atlantic storms because of discrimination and a lack of infrastructure even within the United States in the 1940s.
You know, we're talking about that even still today, especially as these hurricanes come up the coast. A lot of the conversation after those storms rip through and destroy communities is, should we rebuild right here on this coastline?
Right.
Again,
no, absolutely.
And it's, yeah.
Absolutely.
What's interesting is how much of that building is recent. From Virginia to Florida, from 1980 to the early 20th century, a quarter of all American population growth was along that Atlantic coast. And mm-hmm. another large part, of course, is in Texas, where you have everything's enabled by air conditioning, which is a post-World War II innovation. So the migration, voluntary and involuntary, is sort of creating, so to speak, a perfect storm where people mm-hmm. are moving to where the greatest vulnerabilities lie.
We've got to talk about the Dust Bowl, the 1930s, hundreds of thousands of Americans right. displaced at a very difficult time for the country during the Depression. And this was not just weather-related. It also had to do a lot with how Americans were interacting with the land.
So there was severe drought during the 1930s and wind erosion that was accompanied or really came on the heels of really inefficient irrigation techniques. And so anchored soil, you know, basically came up and was turned to dust. And you had over 100 million acres in Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Kansas, and so forth, basically ruined as a result of, again, decades-long degradation. The crop losses alone were $25 million per day. That's in 1936 dollars. So you're wow. talking almost $450 million of losses every single day during the Dust Bowl in the 30s. Well, you have nearly 3 million people who leave the Plain States, most of whom go to California. And California itself begins to then enact a series of laws to basically restrict some of these migrants. In 1933, the Indigent Act in California actually made it a crime to bring indigent persons into the state. You have local attorneys trying to enforce it with verve, and it's not until the ACLU really fights back against this that you get a Supreme Court case in 1941 that actually makes it okay, makes it a law in America to not restrict interstate migration for poor people.
You're right. I'm thinking back to the Grapes of Wrath and the images of the family moving from their homes to the West Coast. They were definitely vilified. People were vilified. These migrants were not treated well. And it gives right. us a hint at what might happen in the future, doesn't it, when this happens, if it happens again.
Well, we need to remember, too, that one reason we have the Grapes of Wrath is that it was about white people moving, right? This is about poor indigent white people. We don't really have representations of people of other ethnic backgrounds who have been displaced and moved. So I think that it's interesting that that gives us something to think with, but it doesn't really reflect the big picture.
Well, I'm from the Southwest, and my family first moved there in the 1950s because at that time the weather was good, the air was clean, and now as I think about how the climate is changing in places like Arizona, Southern California, New Mexico, Colorado, there are wildfires, there are droughts that have literally lasted more than a decade. And I've been wondering, you know, when will people start to leave, but also when will people start staying put in other parts of the country and not coming to places in the Sun Belt? That's got to really affect the economies of a place and the identity of a lot of places.
Well, I grew up in South Florida, and, you know, Miami in a lot of ways is considered to be ground zero of what will be, you know, sea level raises and other kinds of climate concerns. And I've thought about whether or not I could go, you know, and make a snowbird migration like so many folks do in their old age to go back to Florida. So I wish I could say it wasn't a consideration. I mean, some of the projections that we've now seen coming out of these latest reports are saying as early as 2040, you're going to start to see unsustainable crises or irreversible crises in places like South Florida, again, Louisiana, the Gulf Coast. These places are going to be drastically compromised in terms of what the next generation or the generation after will be able to do. So I hope that we're not talking in historical terms about the place that used to be Florida or a place that used to be Louisiana. But there's a very real possibility that, you know, the entire country and really the world is going to have to make a dramatic shift to prevent that history from becoming an eventuality.
Ed, do you agree?
I do. As a mountaineer, it's one of the few cultural advantages I have. I'm from highland. But I think that it's hard for us to imagine just how massive these changes can be. And all we have to do is think back across American history to see how many millions of people have been moved by climate before.
I'm going to move in with you, Ed, if that's okay.
Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, hosts of the podcast Backstory. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amazon now has a $60 microwave that connects to Alexa and can order popcorn when you're low. It is one more foray into the Internet of Things, a world in which every object in your home is connected to the Internet from your refrigerator to your ceiling fan. Joining us now is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, you say this may sound cool and convenient, and we've talked about it before, but there are some big privacy and security risks here.
Absolutely. Anything that you connect to the Internet comes with the potential good and bad the Internet offers. So we've seen hackers get into baby monitors and scream at babies, for instance. You can imagine crazy things like thermostats going off and your pipes freezing while you're on vacation, undetected break-ins because your smart locks have been hacked, people turning off your lights on you. Smart fridges have given away Gmail credentials and payment information in the past. So the more things get connected, the more creative hackers are going to get in breaking into them. And it's not inconceivable that ransomware, for instance, where hackers take over your computer and make you pay up to access it again, could make it into the smart home and could really hold people hostage in their own homes. So this does get kind of scary in this potential future that we're talking about.
So what are these companies doing to help people deal with these issues?
Honestly, not a lot yet. Larger companies have the money to invest in security, but as we saw with 50 million accounts at Facebook being compromised just recently, it's a bit of a crapshoot for consumers, even among big companies, right? There's a cultural thing happening too. Internet-connected tech is trendy, so companies of all sizes are a lot more likely to spend money on connecting something than protecting something once it's connected. Facebook announced this video chatting service portal, and this is a different issue, saying they weren't going to collect user data. Now the company has flip-flopped, saying that user data will be collected, so potentially hackers could get access to that. And it's important to remember that connecting something on the internet also lets companies move the goalposts after you've purchased the product in a kind of unique way. So companies can change terms of service or user agreements that none of us ever read, and voila, we're in this brave new world.
So, of course, anyone could just disconnect entirely, say, I'm not going to have a smart home, I'm not going to have the Internet of Things in my home.
Yeah, that is true, although it does get tricky because, again, a lot of these companies that are making these products are putting the connectivity into the products without really asking the consumers, right? And slow as they may be, government organizations are catching up to this. Better clarity on national global technology standards would be really helpful when it comes to connected devices. That could come through legislation, which is difficult but seems to last longer. Also, the Federal Trade Commission has made some progress on protecting consumer data and putting the onus on companies rather than consumers to bolster those protections. If the FTC updated the fines for companies, like when companies screw up, that would go a long way too. And then we've also seen the European Union and European regulators be more willing and able to exert regulatory powers over companies when it comes to data. So there's something called the e-privacy regulation that is in motion now and will likely sort of go into effect late this year, early next year. And that's really focused on user privacy when it comes to the Internet of Things, though companies say it goes too far in regulating the Internet of Things by making the user agree every time a sensor picks up their information, for instance.
So what do you advise people to do if they're listening to this and they're wondering about their own privacy, their own security, but they also want to maybe have some of the conveniences that are offered from the Internet of Things?
Just move to the woods and go off the grid. No, I mean, my rule of thumb is every time you buy something like this, ask yourself if it needs to be connected to the internet. And often the answer is no, right? And, you know, again, each consumer has to decide for themselves where that line is drawn when it comes to whether it's convenient enough to kind of make the argument to take that risk. It may be that the Internet of Things is coming to our home, whether we like it or not, but we can use our power as consumers to hopefully make smart purchases. And that will then, of course, convince companies that either we want something or we don't. Also, if you're super into the idea of a smart home but don't want to be a casualty of a company's ill-advised decisions about your data, teach yourself to build the thing you want. So, like, learn how to use and program those little Arduino computers that are, at the center of a lot of these smart devices. Take an old smartphone, connect it to Wi-Fi, stick it in your fridge, figure out a way to get that video feed securely so you can check to see whether you've run out of milk. The more we get DIY with technology, the more we learn, and the more we learn as users and consumers, the better we are at having agency and avoiding mistakes and kind of understanding the industry that we're dipping our toes into.
The other way you can check to see if you've run out of milk is just opening the fridge and looking. But, you know, I don't know. I don't work
great
in Silicon Valley.
Great life hack.
Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for us at Here and Now and hosts the podcast with Reddit, Endless Thread. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think they call that the old-fashioned way.
That's the way I check.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.